The views and opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent the views and opinions of WEFT-FM, Prairie Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. And now here is this week's edition of IMC Radio News.
Why do we produce the IMC Radio News?
Because the chasm isn't left to right. It's top to bottom.
To give voice to people who aren't heard.
To bust up the myth of objective journalism.
Bill O'Reilly does not have a monopoly on the truth.
To build our community and re-educate the public.
To revive the voice of organized labor.
To bring forth debate so as to animate democracy.
Because I want to agitate for revolution.
Listen to the voices of your community on IMC Radio News.
It's 5:30 on Monday, and it's time for the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center Radio News, your source for community news on your community radio station, WEFT 90.1 FM. I'm Kimberly Cronick, your host for this week. Our main feature this week takes an alternative view on adoption, but first, this week's headlines. Last Saturday witnessed the kickoff of a new group supporting the creative endeavors of girls and women. The Resource and Action Group of Girls and Women, known as RAG, emerged on the local scene with a day of workshops followed by an evening of open mic performances. Girls and women witnessed a puppet show about body awareness, learned how to make paper airplanes, created jewelry, and learned about what makes political organizing efforts effective. RAG is a local grassroots partnership of girls and women for girls and women, whose aim is to provide safe spaces, resources, and activities to foster creativity, self-expression, and empowerment. Building on the work of Girl Zone, which closed recently, RAG developed out of the community's desire to continue providing social activities and workshops to girls and women in Champaign County. RAG welcomes all girls and women to join in their efforts. They meet every Tuesday at 6:30 p.m. at the Independent Media Center, 218 West Main Street in downtown Urbana. For more details on RAG, see rag.ucimc.org. That's rag.ucimc.org. RadFest is coming this weekend. RadFest is an annual weekend conference in Wisconsin for progressive activists and academics in the Midwest. Also known as the Midwest Social Forum, the central goal of the conference is to provide an opportunity for progressive activists, organizers, and intellectuals to come together to discuss issues, strengthen networks, and devise strategies for progressive social, economic, and political change. The conference has grown significantly in recent years, becoming an important annual gathering for progressives. Workshops this year will put a spotlight on racial equity in schools, Columbia, the School of the Americas, the WTO, Palestine, civil liberties, labor issues, independent media, the occupation in Iraq, Latino organizing, low-power radio, and feminism. Robert McChesney of Media Reform Net, Medea Benjamin of Global Exchange, Jamala Rogers of the Black Radical Congress, and others will be speaking. To view more information or register online, go to havencenter.org. That's HAVENSCENTER.ORG. Jimmy and David are two of the hundreds of thousands who will be converging on New York City in August to protest outside the Republican National Convention. Most will be driving, but Jim and Dave are going to bike to New York from Chicago, and they want you to join them. Jimmy offers his reasons for going. Quote, I hate George Bush. And why is he going by bicycle? Realizing the difficulty of parking cars, buses, or oxen on the island of Manhattan, I've decided to bicycle there from Chicago, he said. They and their travel companions will join a bike block in New York City, which will be holding an alternative convention called the BNC, or Bike National Convention. They will be hosted by the Cyclists for Peace, who are offering accommodations to those who arrive in Manhattan by bike. Jimmy and David are leaving on August 16th from Chicago. To join them, email garrisonkilla@earthlink.net. That's garrisonkilla@earthlink.net, or view their story on the IMC website, ucimc.org. To find out more about protests at the Republican National Convention, go to rncnotwelcome.org. That's rncnotwelcome.org. In an underreported footnote in the News Gazette last week, it was mentioned that the Jack Ryan campaign is stalking Barack Obama, Ryan's contender for the Illinois Senate seat. Ryan has had a campaign staffer, Justin Warfel, follow Obama with a video camera all day. Not only does he record Obama's public appearances, he tails Obama in his car, he follows him into restrooms, he stays a couple of feet behind him when he's walking in public, he waits outside his office and pesters his secretary, and he heckles Obama at public appearances. Ryan's campaign claims he is making sure the Illinois senator does not contradict himself. Some Republicans are displeased with this tactic, saying it is inappropriate and a violation of Obama's privacy. Last Tuesday, America lost one of the great nonviolent activists of the past century. Dave Dellinger died last Tuesday at a nursing home in Mount Pelier, Vermont. According to friends, he had suffered from Alzheimer's disease. Dellinger was born in Wakefield, Massachusetts, to a well-to-do family. His father was a lawyer and a prominent Republican. A Yale and Oxford student, he also studied theology at Union Theological Seminary. Rejecting his comfortable background, he walked out of Yale one day to go and live with the homeless during the Depression. For more than 60 years, Dave Dellinger was at the forefront of movements for peace and social justice. He refused to serve in World War II, for which he was jailed. In jail, he led hunger strikes and protests against jail conditions, including racial segregation, solitary confinement, and the hole, which was known to create mental illness in prisoners. During the 1950s and 1960s, Dellinger joined freedom marches in the South and led many hunger strikes in jail. As U.S. involvement in Vietnam grew, Dellinger applied Gandhi's principles of nonviolence to his activism within the growing anti-war movement, of which one of its high points was the Chicago 8 trial, of which he was one of the eight. Dave Dellinger worked to end U.S. atrocities in Central America in the 80s and against the recent war in Afghanistan. In 2001, Dellinger led a group of young activists from Mount Pelier, Vermont, to Quebec City to protest the creation of the Free Trade Area of the Americas. His autobiography is called Yale to Jail. Dave Dellinger had last visited Urbana-Champaign in the 1990s when he and his spouse, Elizabeth Peterson, were in residence at Allen Hall. They also spoke at the School for Designing a Society. Near the end of his life, struggling with hearing problems and advancing Alzheimer's, Dave composed a poem that described his approach to life. I love everyone, even those who disagree with me. I love everyone, even those who agree with me. I love everyone, rich and poor, and I love everyone of different races, including people who are indigenous, wherever they live, in this country or elsewhere. I love everyone, whatever religion they are, and atheists too, people who contemplate wherever it leads them. I love everyone, both in my heart and in my daily life. We lost Dave Dellinger last Tuesday, May 25th, at the age of 89.
Sleep well, beloved comrade. The fight will just begin. The fight will go on until we win. Until.
And now for this week's IMC Radio News feature. IMC reporter Andine Gross interviews Robin Fossum, a person who was adopted and who presents a critical view of adoption that we don't often hear.
To most Americans, the word adoption conjures the image of an infant being placed into the loving arms of a couple or single parent that can provide a good home. Most of us know somebody who was adopted, and many of us have seen our friends adopting babies, often internationally. We're happy for the infertile couple because they have found a baby to love, and we consider the infants fortunate because we're certain that this adoption saved them from a much harsher fate. At least that's a paradigm that most of us believe, and we don't think much more about it. Today we're talking with Robin Fossum. herself an adoptee, and somebody who spent a good number of years thinking about adoption from a very different perspective. But the first thing you should know about Robin is that she is strikingly beautiful in an Italian, Hispanic, Native American, or Russian sort of way. But which is it? That's a question Robin has been asked all of her life. Welcome, Robin.
Thank you, Andy.
Robin, how did you answer that question of where are you from?
Oh, that's very difficult. I was raised in the northern suburbs of Chicago, and my high school and grade schools were all white American children, and I was always a little darker and more exotic looking. And I was raised in a Jewish family, so when I was young, I would say I was Jewish.
Well, I read that adoption was created as a means of finding homes for children who needed them, but that adoption is now being used to find children for infertile couples. How do you react to that statement?
I think that's what has happened in the United States, and particularly because of our wealth. It has turned from where children who really need homes to women who are actually giving up babies with pride that they didn't have an abortion to a couple. But it's all, I think, very selfish in many ways. I'm not saying in every case, but in many cases, it's accepted that giving up a child is the right thing to do. It's the only thing to do. It makes people feel good that they're doing a good thing. It makes the churches feel good that there wasn't an abortion. And for women and families who adopt children, they think this is fulfilling their lives, their love, something they've always wanted to do because they haven't been able to have children and they can give this. But not once is it mentioned about the child. What does the child think about this? I am not an angry person about this, but I also realized that all of this that happened to me in my particular story was not my fault. I had absolutely no say in anything that happened.
So let's talk a little bit more about that psychological impact. As you mentioned, birth mothers are told they're doing the right thing and what's best for the baby. Let's start with the mothers. Are these mothers being sold a bill of goods?
I think so. I think especially in our white American society, yes. They're told that they can't provide for the child what another couple could give more. And the bottom line is materialism will never overcome love and your natural family. I think everybody pays the price, and forever and ever. Some of the mothers I have run into, at the time, it's the right thing, and most of them will say they had no choice. But if they really had the choice, they would have kept their child, whether they were 15 or 32, whatever the circumstances was at that time, the regret is deep and it's forever. I've seen other instances in birth mothers who think they're doing a good thing for society because their church tells them it's a good thing you're doing, and so they get all that village support from their church. But what about the child? Is this the good thing for the child to be taken away from its mother?
Do you think that at some deep instinctual level, adopted children might feel like something is amiss, just in terms of even fitting into their adoptive family?
I think so, definitely. You don't feel part of it. On the other hand, it can work well when you're a teenager going through difficult years that every single person questions their identity. You also look at your adopted family, and when they're being a little crazy, you think, oh, well, I'm not really part of them. And so sometimes it can be, you know, positive that you know you're from somewhere else. But you just made me think, what about these stories that we're so in awe of a cat who was found, the family moved to Washington, state of Washington, and the cat got lost at a rest stop in Nebraska, and 3 years later, the cat found its way to Washington. Mm-hmm. I mean, the instincts, those are basic instincts of life. And until I found my birth family, I had to find them. I had to know it wouldn't stop. Nothing would stop me but society. And they stopped me at every door that it could to try to find my family.
Let's talk about those barriers in terms of even rights for adopted children to find their roots. And what were some of those barriers that affected you?
The first barrier is our country and the state of Illinois. I think we like to proclaim and fly our flags that, you know, we Americans are the best society and the most democratic society. And the truth is, I don't have the right to see my birth certificate. I don't have the right to see what hospital I was born at or who were my parents. It's sealed and locked by the government in Springfield, Illinois. There's your first barrier. It goes on from there. Fortunately, though, times have changed. I'm a product of the 50s and 60s, and it still exists today, but there is also now the new concept started about 25, 30 years ago about open adoption. So things have changed, fortunately, and it's probably through people like myself who have expressed the sadness of going through life and not being able to find information.
Mm-hmm. Is adoption big business? Are there people who gain financially?
I think that's true. In my case also, it was a private adoption. So it wasn't through a charity or an orphanage or a service. From my understanding, what I have found out, there was money exchanged under the table. It was called a black market adoption. I was sold. Essentially, I was sold to a couple who wanted a baby. And it may sound harsh, but that is the truth. And now what's happening, even with open adoptions, that you do give money to the potential birth mother and pay her expenses and sweeten the pot if you can, and most do, because they want a better chance of getting the baby. And when you get the baby, there's no guarantee that, or when she has the baby, there is not a guarantee you're actually going to get the baby. So money is made and lost, and I've actually seen figures in the $100,000 range is the price of an average of adoption. That's probably not as legal as the regular adoption, which is probably between $18,000 and $35,000, guesstimate.
What about international adoption? Do you think that there's baby brokering and baby selling big time?
I've had a lot of experiences. Fortunately, I've traveled many, many corners of the world, and I ask a lot of these questions and try to find out in different cultures. And definitely, there's black market adoptions going on all the time. Nobody talks about it. But I also think it's even worse, you know, through taking children out of their totally different cultures and bringing them to the United States. It's not as easy as it sounds.
Let's talk a little bit about your story. You were, 12 or 13 when you were ruffling through your father's desk drawer and came upon the name of your birth name.
When I saw those papers of my sister's adoption papers and my adoption papers, we are not biological sisters, but we were raised together. I saw that name, and it just ingrained on me. It was an unusual name, and I'll never forget it. And it's like, oh my gosh, that's who I really am. And I thought it was my mother's name. I immediately looked in the phone books at that time. And when I was 18, I'd look in the Chicago phone books because I heard I was born in Chicago. Actually, on my birth certificate, your birth certificate is a phony. It has your adoptive parents' name on it, and everything else is blank. I'll never know to this day how much I weighed at birth or where I was born. And all it was signed by a doctor, and that doctor, I looked him up. Even I went over to the public library, and I found the AMA journal when I was 17 or 18, and I found the doctor's name, and he had an address in Chicago around Diversey and Ashland, I think. And so I said, okay, I must be born in Chicago, and I'd look up that name, and I'd see the names, and then I was after college, and I was married, and I had children. I'd always look at that name, but I never wanted to spend money on myself to go find out. And then I think when my children were about 5 and 7 or 8, I found Truth Seekers. It's an adoption group. And I went to a meeting somewhere by O'Hare Airport. And they said to me, I said, well, all I have is a name. They said, well, if you have a name, that means you were baptized. Because usually the names on the adoption certificate say baby girl Doe. And then the name like Smith or Hanson or whatever. And mine actually had a first and a last name. She said, that meant you were baptized. And then I thought,
oh my gosh, I was raised Jewish and I was baptized. That's interesting. And so then I did that step. Then I drove by the doctor's offices. So it would be on and off, though, for the past 40 years, well, 30 years, that I've been, it's up and I'm looking, and but I didn't want to interfere with my life. And also I had deep threat from my adopted parents that if I ever looked, I'm disloyal, it's not respectful, I should be grateful. And I would ask once, I think when I was 16, you know, why can't you tell me? And I was slapped in the face. Don't ever talk about it. And you're here, and, you know, we love you. And I'm like, what? So to this day, I cannot bring up the word adoption in front of my mother. My friends were always understanding and wonderful, and my husband was always supportive. I've never had, you know, I've had that support, which has been vital. And then when I had children, of course, they know about it, and they are all happy. You know, when I find out information, I would tell them, because they would always say, people ask them, where are they from?
So let's go back to your story. You recently did locate your birth family. Tell us how that unfolded and what it felt like.
When my youngest was finishing college, I finally decided, all right, now I'm going to spend money on this, because my children were my priority. And now that they're grown, now I'm going to do this. I have to. I can't go on anymore without doing this. And plus, I know it's getting late if anybody's still alive. And I went to Champaign-Urbana. I had an adoption triangle group that was advertised in the News Gazette. And I went to a meeting with my husband as my support. And we listened to the story. And it's called the Adoption Triad or Triangle. And that consists of adoptees, mothers who give up their children for adoption, and couples that adopt children. And I was in this room, and about maybe 10 people, and they all told their story, and I was like, whoa, this is interesting. And I told my little story that I was born in Chicago, I didn't know where, and I had a name, but I didn't know anything about where I was from. And afterwards, the leader of the group was quite wonderful, and she came up to me and says, I think I could help you. I paid her an initial fee, and she had my name, and she wrote letters to people in Chicago. And sure enough, within a few months, we started getting responses. I was very ill about 10 years ago, which also bring into the question my adoption, because every single surgeon want to know, the first thing when I would go in their office, what is your family history on cancer? We need to know this. And I'm like, I don't know. I don't know anything. And it's like, oh, there it is again. But anyway, I got letters. So at that time, in the state of Illinois, my records are sealed, but you're allowed non-identifying information. And that information, the judge, it took a process of about 4 months, and he wrote back to me finally, after a few correspondence, that my mother was 30, my father was 33, I was the fourth birth, and I was born in Chicago. And I almost fainted, because I thought my mom was 16. My fantasy all these years was my mom was a teenager. That's why you give people up, isn't it? And then I was a fourth birth. Does that mean I have brothers and sisters? Oh my gosh. So now 10 years later, kids are grown. I go, she writes letters, we get response. She called me up, says, I think I found your brother. That was the first contact, and he agreed to meet me.
Mm. And it was a successful reunification and emotionally?
I was just plain scared. I was so scared to meet him. And the only person I've ever seen that looked like me have been my children. And I meet him at his home in northern Illinois by the Wisconsin border, and out comes this tall, blue-eyed man. And I thought he would be darker and not as tall like my son. And no, and I was like, oh my gosh. And he gave me a big hug, and I'm looking at him and like, oh my God, I was so scared. I was shaking. I didn't cry, but I was just like, I couldn't keep my eyes off of him and just wanting to look. Like, are his cheeks like my cheekbones? Are his nose? Well, his nose is a little different, but look at his eyes, look at his hair, look at, you know, and his arms. Oh, his arms didn't have hair on them, just like mine. And it was just like everything I've been wanting to see that I never got to see and maybe take it for granted. I couldn't take this for granted. I've been waiting for this my whole life. It was fantastic. Mm. He then contacted my mother, was still alive, And he told me I had a brother. He was my brother. I had an older sister, another sister, and a half-sister. My mother had remarried. Apparently, my parents had divorced a year after I was born. And she remarried, and I had a half-sister, and I looked like her, too. And he said as soon as he got my letter and pictures, he went over to my mom, and he brought them to her, and he said, "Look what I got. I think we may have a sister." And he says, "Mom, if we do, this would be the greatest gift at this age or this time in our lives." And she looked at it, and she shook her head, and he said she was saying, no, I don't know. And he said, "I could tell that was, she really knew that this, you were her daughter, but she would not admit it to us." And then he told me, "We're going to work on her very gently and lovingly, but we're going to work on her because after he saw me, he said, I know you're my sister." Mm. And then in September, they were talking about it, and she said, called him up and said, "Well, I'm not getting any younger. Yeah, I really want to meet her." But then I did meet her, and she went to my brother's house with my sisters, and I was just, again, just scared more than anything. Like, what do I say? Or, yeah, I know she did this for whatever reasons, and I know this is not my fault. You know, I didn't do anything. I'm just trying to find who they are, what are they like, and am I like them? I met my brother, and we went into the house, and she was on the deck, and I looked out the window, and she was looking for me too, and she had this big smile on her face, and I just took all the guts in the world I had, and I walked out on the deck, and I went up to her, and we gave each other a hug, and I looked at her, and she looked at me, and she was just as scared as I was. We are both the same in so many ways, in the way we speak, in the way we act. Our personnel, I mean, it was all the same. I gave her a picture, a book of me growing up, you know, with just me, not my sister or parents, you know, just pictures of me in different stages of my life and that I put together. And she gave me a picture of her when she was younger. And then I gave her flowers and she gave me flowers. We gave each other the same exact thing. Yeah. It was so funny. And we didn't cry, but everybody else around us was crying. I met my birth mother, and 4 months later, she died. One of the poignant things I found out is, and it was last January, and at her funeral, her sisters, who were in their 80s, came up to me and said, "We begged your mom to keep you. We begged her. You were the fourth child, and we don't know what, we just told her." And I'm listening to this like, oh my gosh, I should have been with my family. But something happened that... And she was so proud of me, too, at the end. And she kept telling my brother, she says, "I can't believe she turned out like that. I'm so glad. I'm so happy." And it's, everything was good, but so wrong, you know, after so many years.
Given your experience in the sense of, for lack of a better word, psychological closure, it seems like you've obtained from this journey, do you have any ideas about a way to do adoption that reduces psychological damage?
Well, I guess I have turned radical on that point. I think adoption is wrong, period. I was listening to a vet show the other day, and on our public radio station, talking about doggies and kitty cats and whatnot, and then someone says, "Well, no, this one will be available for adoption, you know, when it's about 2 months old or three," and I thought, wait a minute. You can keep dogs with their mothers for 9 weeks before they're supposed to be put out to a home. Dogs, but children, you're supposed to take away immediately, so there's no bonding going on. So they won't get the nutrition, the love, the security, anything that's very natural. Adoption is not natural. And then I said that to someone, and they said, "Well, of course you take them away right away, because then they'll start bonding with their mother, and their mother would never give them up." Like, yes. So I think in the case of, there are family situations, but other countries in the world that are civilized will
help support that mother or that family financially. They will have nurses that come to the house twice a week, three times a week to check on the status of the baby. The child is precious. The child should be kept in the family. The child psychologically will be rooted in the right place. They may not like it. Sometimes we don't like our families, even they're natural. But at least this huge question and their heritage and their culture will be with them. And then when you're adults, you can do whatever you want. But I think you're really ripping children away from the naturalness that nature has provided, and I think is just not right.
Robin Fossum, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
That wraps up IMC Radio News for this week. This week's show producer was Danielle Chenoweth. Ondine Gross produced our feature on an alternative look to adoption. Technical assistance from Clint Popetz. If you'd like to get involved with the show, drop us a line at radio@ucimc.org or call 344-8820. No experience is necessary. Archives of this program are available at the IMC website, ucimc.org. I'm Kimberly Cronick.